The opinions expressed by the host and guests on Where Did the Road Go are their own and do not represent those of WVBR or its management. Our aim is to explore the fringe, lost civilizations, alternative science, the paranormal, and much more. Join us on the web at wheredidtheroadgo.com, where you can send us questions for our live or future guests via email or the live chat room. And remember to subscribe to us on iTunes. And now welcome to this week's edition of Where Did the Road Go?
And welcome to this edition of Where Did the Road Go? I am your host, Soraya. And we're going to start off with a little bit of sad news. Christopher Jordan, who we had as a guest on this show May 7th, passed away this last week, September 22nd, early morning. He was living in Cambodia, which is where we interviewed him from. He was found by his wife just after 6:10 a.m. Monday, the 22nd of September. Cause of death yet to be established. I believe he was in his early 50s. And I really liked talking with Chris. We talked about his book, The Ark of the Covenant Operations Manual. He has six other titles to his credit, and he had a very different way of looking at things. I enjoyed speaking with him, and I had hoped to have him back on. But obviously, that was not to be. So I highly recommend going to check out the interview. It's, as I said, very unique. He's not very well known, because he kind of falls between the cracks in a lot of stuff. But yes, sad news from this week's for this week's show. And this week's show is dedicated to the memory of Chris Jordan as well. And for this week's show, we have back with us Mr. Laird Scranton. Now, Laird has a new book out entitled China's Cosmological Prehistory, The Sophisticated Science Encoded in Civilization's Earliest Symbols. It's a fantastic book. It's the fourth in his series. The others are Science of the Dogon, Sacred Symbols of the Dogon, and Cosmological Origins of Myth and Symbol. We've also had him on for the Velikovsky Heresies. But this is the fourth in the series of books that explore ancient symbols and cosmology and creation myths and the like, and tie them all together and show that there's a common core behind them all. And as you'll hear from Laird, he also has another book already done that will be coming out early next year that takes this yet further. We talk a little bit about that, but not too much. We're going to wait till the book comes out to discuss that further. This book in itself was more than enough to discuss. It is a fascinating piece of work. It is a unique piece of work, really. I don't think anyone else has done this type of research. And we go all over the place, as many interviews here do. We get into elements of modern cosmology and alternative theories and reality itself, as well as a little bit into synchronicity too near the end. So I found it to be a fascinating conversation. Hopefully we're going to be doing some more with Laird very soon on video as well, since he doesn't live very far from here. So we're going to be putting something together kind of special with him and maybe someone else video wise. But Laird is also an independent software designer and has been studying ancient myth, language, and cosmology for more than a decade. He's an authority on Dogon mythology and symbolism, and I think the software designer part of it kind of helps him do this type of stuff, and I believe we discussed that briefly during this interview as well. All right, so again, check our YouTube page, the website, which has links to everything, www.wheredidtheroadgo.com. And without any further ado, here's my discussion with Laird Scranton. And I'd like to welcome Laird Scranton back to the show. How are you doing, Laird?
Oh, I'm doing great, Sarai. How are you?
All right. And you just released China's Cosmological Prehistory, The Sophisticated Science Encoded in Civilization's Earliest Symbols. And when did this come out?
This was out, actually, it's just been out for 2 weeks now. So it's a brand new. I'm very glad to have printed copies of this at last.
How long have you been working on this one?
This one was about a year and a half. There was a delay at in the publishing of it. I would have liked to have had it out quicker than it was, but there have been changes at inner traditions that I think caused them to put things off a little bit.
Okay. And it is out on Inner Traditions.
Yes.
And your last book was actually the one on Velikovsky, right?
That's right, the one right preceding this. This is the fourth in a series, and there are another book due out in February from Inner Traditions, and then a follow-on to that one that's due that I just finished writing.
Oh, okay, all right. So the other one's actually done, and you're just waiting for them to publish it.
That's right. Actually, we're in the midst of it. One of the things I returned to from my recent trip was an edit waiting to be reviewed.
Nice.
The book is called Point of Origin, and it's already on. You can find it on Amazon.com already. It's actually selling better than some of my other books already.
Oh, wow. All right. Well, let's talk about this one, China's Cosmological Prehistory.
Okay.
Now, being the fourth in the series, it's not necessary that people read the other three, because you kind of sum up some of the information of the other three in here.
That's right. Actually, that's a fairly common complaint I get from people who read series of books, is that it seems that each next book, more and more of the material is devoted to summarizing what happened previously. And I've been in the next book, I'm trying to get away from that and just explain what the reader really needs for that single book. This book does a pretty good job of summarizing the critical information from the previous book, so that someone doesn't necessarily have to have read the previous books to read this one.
Yeah, and I noticed that. It wasn't like I was reading the same book over again by any means.
Well, I'm glad to hear that.
Now, one of the things you do is you take sort of the pronunciation of words in very ancient Egypt and the Dogons and from other cultures, and show this common connection between them. What made you start doing this?
Okay, well, my research started with the Dogon in Africa, a modern day tribe in Mali. And I noticed early on in my research, because the Dogon have civic traditions that are a lot like ancient Egypt, I noticed that a lot of the words in their cosmology were also Egyptian words. And I was able to correlate things back and forth. Since that time, through my studies, I've noticed the farther back in time you go, the more commonality you have of these terms. And I had noticed it in connection with Göbekli Tepe. My friend John Anthony West and Robert Schock were going to visit there, and I had done some study of some things at Göbekli Tepe and realized there was a commonality of language there. And so when I came into China, the book about China, that's the first thing I looked at was, do we have common techniques of writing things and common ways of pronouncing things, and can I use what I already know about the other cultures to interpret China?
And you've also connected it to Buddhism and in some aspects of Judaism too, right?
That's right. Actually, a lot of the Dogon and Egyptian words are also Hebrew words.
Hmm. And this, of course, suggests there may be a common origin below all of this.
Right. And really, that's what I'm getting to. In the third book of my series, a book called The Cosmological Origins of Myth and Symbol, I actually go so far as to lay out what I consider to be the signature elements of this tradition that I would expect to find in another culture if they had the same tradition. And I used that to predict what I would find in Tibet when I looked at a tribe called the Naki. I use a lot of those same signatures to drive this China book, that my expectation is that certain things are going to be in common that are critical to the tradition if it really is the same tradition.
Okay. Now, let's jump over to the Dogon real quick. And I'm pretty sure we covered this in the past, but for anyone who didn't hear the last interview, the thing that most people know about the Dogon, if they know anything, is that they had knowledge of Sirius.
Right. And that's true, but it's really just the tiniest tip of the iceberg of what their tradition communicates scientifically. They knew that the bright star of Sirius, which is the, if you look up in the night sky, is probably the brightest star you see, that it isn't really a single star. It really represents at least two stars. There's a bright sun-like star and a dark dwarf star that orbit each other. And they not only knew about the existence of the second star, they knew the correct orbital period for the two stars.
And this, of course, and I think it was Temple who put out the book claiming that this was evidence of extraterrestrial contact, but that's not necessarily the case, is it?
Well, it depends on how you look at it. My approach with the first books I was writing was to hit softly on that until I had some kind of evidence that I could point to that would support the arguments I wanted to make. A lot of the things that the temple interprets as being evidence of an alien contact, I interpret as being cosmological references. The Dogon society is very closely intertwined with their cosmology. So whenever they make a statement, it can sometimes be a little tricky to sort out, are they talking about something historic here, or are they talking about something mythical?
I see. Okay. Because the claim was that they claim their ancestors were from Sirius, correct?
Not really. That was an interpretation of temples. The Dogon and the Buddhists, as it turns out, both flatly claim to have had non-human help in ancient times. But the Dogon are not so much pointing at traditional sci-fi aliens as they are a kind of a spiritual connection to another, like a paired universe with the Earth.
Really? Okay, like a multiverse type of thing?
Yeah, in the Dogon conception of how the universe forms, which is something astrophysicists don't really even talk about, universes form in pairs, and every pair involves one that is material in nature like ours, and the other is non-material. And from the Dogon perspective, their instructors, the people that they got their civilizing knowledge from and their scientific knowledge from, they claim are associated with Sirius, but not because they came from there. They're more connected with this non-material shamanic type side.
And I know you're familiar, and I'm pretty sure I asked you this before. You're familiar with Walter Cruttenton's work.
Right, absolutely. Yep.
And you've appeared on his CPAC conferences.
That's right. I'll be there again this year, the third weekend in October.
Okay. That's awesome. Is it possible, if he's right and Sirius is our binary companion, that, I mean, his idea is that as Sirius gets closer, we develop abilities that we don't have, that it's somehow affecting our consciousness in a way. Is it possible that it's allowing us to cross over to that world when Sirius is nearby and that's where the connection comes from?
Again, yes and no. The Dogon and the Buddhist outlook agrees with the idea that there is a rotation, the grand rotation of precession of the equinoxes,
right,
a very slow rotation that's being caused by a relationship between Sirius and the Earth. According to the Dogon, Sirius regulates our region of space. Now, the relationship is sort of akin to when you were a child playing on a playground in a park. If you got on a merry-go-round and you were sitting across from another child, you know, and somebody spun the merry-go-round, everything around you would spin from your perspective except the child who was sitting across from you. Because they were moving at the same rate you were, it looked like that they didn't move. Well, this is what happens with precession between the Earth and Sirius, is that Sirius is one of a handful of stars that don't precess. And my outlook on why that is comes from the Dogon, and that's because there's a slow rotation going on that is actually centered on Sirius and the Earth. And so this slow turning of that cycle is what connects to Walter Cruttenton's Yuga cycle. Whether the effects are what he thinks they are as we approach and move away from the galactic center, I don't have direct information on. But I can say it looks like that rotation does exist.
You said there are a few other stars that don't precess?
Yes, there are others that don't precess the same way or at the same rate of the other stars. This is a little difficult to explain. In another aspect of my book, Cosmological Origins of Myth and Symbol, the Dogon explain why I'm getting ahead of myself here. You may recall that Robert Bovall claims that the three pyramids at the Giza Plateau represent the belt stars of Orion.
Right.
Okay, now he states that, and he explains how that is, but he doesn't really give a rationale for why it was done. The Dogon have a similar tradition of placing stones on plateaus to represent stars, including the belt stars, and they say there's a reason why they do it. The reason is to draw our attention to a structure in the macrocosm, in the universe out there, that we might not be aware of, that they say is a correlate to the fundamental component of matter in the microcosm. These are the two structures that you can relate to one another to prove the phrase as above, so below. So through my research, there's a myth in Dogon culture that describes a character named Ogo who plays the role of light, who measures out the universe in 8 billion steps. A step, the term step, is code for a qubit. Well, I know that the universe doesn't measure 8 billion qubits, but it does measure one commonly given figure for the size of the visible universe is 8 billion light years. And so I could see that it looked as if someone were setting up a relationship between qubits and light years. So then I went and I looked at the Egyptian word for light year, and it's actually, for a qubit, it's actually a compound of two words that mean light and measure, or light and qubit. So the Egyptian word makes it look like it might represent a light year. So then I consider the fact that the way we know how big a qubit is from the dimensions of the Great Pyramid. It measures 440 qubits per side of its square base and 280 qubits high. So I went to my computer and I typed into Google 440, 280, and Orion. And what I turned up were references to a very faint structure you can't see with the naked eye called Barnard's Loop. It's a spiraling birthplace of stars that centers right on the belt stars of Orion, that when you get to the bottom of the Dogon and the Buddhist traditions, this is the structure that I feel is causing that rotation. And at the center of that structure, although you can't see it from the Earth because it's set obliquely to our point of view, Sirius actually sits at the center of that spiral.
Wow. So you don't think that Sirius is necessarily moving closer or further away in any great way?
No, I think that there's a binary rotation that that the astronomers don't have a grasp on right now that is causing this to happen. We can point to the fact that there are forces acting in the universe that the astrophysicists don't really have a grasp on yet. It was discovered about a year and a half ago that the rotation of Venus has slowed down 6 minutes in like 12 years' time, the speed of its rotation on its axis. And they have no idea what force could possibly be acting on Venus to do that.
Well, that brings us back to your Velikovsky book, in that Venus may be a newcomer to our solar system.
Right. But for its rotation to be slowing, there would have to be a force acting on it that the astronomers have not yet tied down.
I see what you're saying. Okay. Huh.
So I think that there's a similar type force acting between Sirius and the sun that the astronomers also haven't quite tied down yet.
Now, there are some people who will say the Dogon didn't really have this information to begin with, that they picked it up from travelers. I think Carl Sagan was one of the people who said that they just picked it up from travelers and that they didn't know any of this stuff before contact with our culture.
Right. Well, that's easily disproved, because the body of cosmology that information comes out of is all expressed using ancient Egyptian words that went out of use around 700 BC. So you could postulate that a modern observer or a modern knowledgeable person brought the information to the Dogon, but what credible modern visitor would have given it to them using ancient Egyptian words? Also, because they are ancient Egyptian words, you can correlate the words, and that means that the Egyptians knew what the Dogon know. In Egypt, the way the symbolism works with stars and deities, it's generally accepted that the goddess Isis represents Sirius. But it's also, in order to say that, you sort of have to tacitly agree to play a symbolic game. And the game is, when I say goddess, you say star. Well, it turns out that Isis has a dark sister named Nephthys. So if we're still playing that game, I say goddess, you say star, the Egyptians are telling us they also know there's a second star in that system.
Wow. It's just never been looked at like that, so no one noticed.
Right.
Huh. one of the things you do too is you show that there is with the Dogon language and ancient Egyptian language, there's, and some of these other cultures have like two different meanings for a word that are not associated with one another, but in these various cultures, that same difference is there.
Yes, then this is one of the features of the cosmology that make it possible to correlate the terms of the cosmology, the creation tradition, between cultures. And these meanings don't really float with the phonetic value. They really float with the concept. I'll give you an example that the Dogon creator god named Ama, who is their hidden god, the term Ama also means to grasp or to hold firm. When you go to Egypt, you have a creator god named Amen, who's also their hidden god, and his name also means to grasp or hold firm or establish. When you go to Hebrew, you have the term Amen that falls at the end of a prayer. That comes from a Hebrew word that means to establish. So you've got correlations here that are not traditional linguistic etymologies, but they move beyond coincidence because you've got multiple points of evidence correlating to multiple points of evidence. You've got a deity who plays a role, a specific role in a cosmology, who has a particular relationship to other deities. You've got the multiple meanings of the words themselves. You've got the pronunciation of the words. And you have more than ample evidence to positively correlate each of these Dogon words to Egyptian words. And I've spent a large part of the last 20 years demonstrating how these words and symbols correlate to each other.
Okay. One of the things you postulate is that they are talking also about a creation concept similar to the Big Bang Theory.
Right. Actually, I've run the Dogon system by astrophysicists who should know. And the response I got back was whoever had put the Dogon system together knew what they were talking about, and it represents a version of string theory called torsion theory. Basically, the main difference between torsion theory and string theory, traditional string theory, is that in torsion theory, it's thought that at every point in space-time, there's a tiny little whirling vortex, like a whirlpool in the ocean, and that those vortices are what are responsible for the creation of gravity.
Hmm. Okay. I guess my follow-up question here is that what if the Big Bang Theory turns out to be wrong? I mean, it does have competing theories like the electric universe and stuff. Would some of these similarities still hold up with other theories? Like if you compare it to like the electric universe or like even the theory of a holographic universe?
Well, the theory of the holographic universe is completely compatible with what the Dogon and the Buddhists say.
That's what I thought.
Yeah, from their perspective, our universe is, they define it as a shadow or a reflection of a more fundamental reality that exists in waves.
Okay.
So essentially what we perceive as being reality is a kind of a hologram. I compare it to before you had cable television. Television was broadcast through the air as waves, and every television program existed as waves until and unless you turned your TV on and it got translated into an image that you could watch. But whether you watched that image or not, it was still there. It existed as waves. Well, that's sort of the way that reality works according to the Dogon and the Buddhists, that at bottom, our reality exists in the form of waves, and every act of perception that we make effectively turns that television set on and creates an image that we respond to.
Okay. What about the electric universe theory? Have you looked much into that?
There are aspects of the electric universe theory that I know are compatible. As far as the Big Bang itself being wrong, my particular outlook is that working with the Dogon and the Buddhist systems is kind of like having the teacher's copy of the book when you were in elementary school. Okay? That you've got a situation where someone has the printed the answers to the questions at the back of the book. And these people are not saying, we think this is how things work. They're saying, this is how things work. And they're saying that the Big Bang is something that happened. They even tell us what existed before the Big Bang. And so my outlook is that when the answers are finally arrived at by the astrophysicists, that it's going to include an event that looks like the Big Bang.
Okay. All right. Now, part of the problem you had with China is that a lot of China's ancient past just isn't that accessible.
Right. The problem in China, and actually China was a very good exercise for me, because the problem is that events that transpired around 3000 BC, we don't have textual references to until around 300 BC. And so you've got this gap of thousands of years. And because of that gap, all of the academics are continually fighting and bickering over every little subtle nuance of every symbol and every word. They have nothing to ground, to anchor their interpretations on. And any interpretation they do make, and I can come along and say, oh, well, look, there was 2,500 or almost 3,000 years between the event and when it was written down. How can you say that's absolutely true? So my approach has been, in order to be able to bridge that gap, one of my approaches has been to use language. Now, if I had had perfect knowledge before I started, I could have demonstrated a positive correlation between the Chinese hieroglyphic language and the Egyptian language based on a single word. And that word is a word that means weak. In Egypt, it's written with the sun glyph, which is a circle with a dot, and the Egyptian number 10, which looks like an upside down U. And I looked at that word, and I said, symbolically, this word says to me 10 days. And I went and I did some research and discovered the Egyptians had a 10-day week. So in effect, the Egyptian word, if you read it symbolically rather than phonetically, explains its own meaning to you. When we go to China, the Chinese word for week is written with two glyphs. The Chinese sun glyph, which is originally a circle with a dot, and the Chinese number 10. It also says 10 weeks or 10 days. And the Chinese also had a 10-day week.
Well, when you get to something like a sun glyph, couldn't someone argue that it was just a common sense symbol for the sun?
You could, until you understand how that glyph derives for the Dogon and for the Buddhists, and how, the cosmology is understood to have existed before written language. And a lot of the symbols of the Egyptian hieroglyphic language take the same shapes and the same meanings as cosmological drawings the Dogon have. The Dogon don't have a written language. Now, this circle with a dot in the center of it is part of a system of alignment for ritual shrines. In Buddhism, there's a shrine called a stupa, and the Dogon have a shrine that is a match for a stupa called a granary. And the process they use to align this to north, south, east, and west creates that circle with a dot in the middle of it. And as effectively, that circle with the dot becomes a working sundial that they can use to tell time with. But it also creates, if you mark the longest shadows of a day at the points where they intersect this circle of the sundial, you create an east-west aligned line that moves day by day. It moves farther away from the center every day until you hit the solstice, and then it turns around and moves back until the equinox. It crosses the center of the circle again. So the same figure is essentially a calendar that lets you track the seasons of the year.
Okay.
Right. Now, when you go to Egyptian hieroglyphic language, the circle with the dot in the middle of it represents the concept of a day, the concept of time, and it can represent the sun, which is the body that casts the shadows that creates its figure. So you have the three cosmological meanings associated with the shape existing both in the Egyptian hieroglyphic language and the Chinese hieroglyphic language. So it's pretty clear from those multiple points of connection that the cosmological shape was adopted wholesale when they created written language.
Okay, all right. What about an explanation like something coming out of the collective consciousness of ancient cultures?
You could go there, but the problem is there's no way to prove that it exists. Jung postulated that it exists as a way of explaining why you have such similarity of symbols from culture to culture. But that's not what the cultures themselves say when you get down to the bottom of it. When you get to the bottom of the cultures I've studied, they all say the same thing, and that is, we got this system of symbols and myths and meanings from someone who knew a lot more than we did in ancient times.
So I guess one of the million-dollar questions there is, who was that?
Well, the Buddhists say flatly that it was a non-human source. The Dogon go a little bit further, and they say not only was it a non-human source, it was a non-material source. However, this non-material source found a way to manifest itself enough in our reality that they were concerned about what the long-term effects were going to be of them on us. And so rather than them coming into a tribe like, you know, like a culture like the Dogon culture and teaching everybody, they didn't want to take that risk because they felt there were health risks involved. And so instead what they did was they sequestered 8 Dogon tribes people at some remote locale and taught them skills of civilization and let them go back and teach their tribe mates.
Okay. And that's sort of their interpretation of it. Is it possible we were dealing with a lost civilization?
Again, it's a complicated question. There are, depending on time for the time frame you're discussing, there are, I see, 3 sets of influences going on here. There's, if you imagine the Ice Age at roughly 12,500 years ago, the end of the Ice Age as being sort of a boundary, this instructive plan, this civilizing plan was meant to help us recover from that disaster, basically.
Right, that cataclysm, yeah.
So you have the influence at 10,500 BC of this apparent instruction. You also have possible influences before the Ice Age from cultures that may have existed before the Ice Age. And then it looks to me as if there's a third influence that comes in around 3200 BC that's related to the 10,500 BC people.
Okay, all right. And, some of this goes into your next book, which is on Göbekli Tepe.
Yeah, well, the next book is called Point of Origin, and actually I had a long negotiation with a publisher about keeping the word Göbekli Tepe out of the title.
Really? Why?
Because although it does tie the cultures in Africa and Egypt and India and Tibet and China back to a point of origin that's in the era of Göbekli Tepe and that ties to Göbekli Tepe as an instructional sanctuary, the book is not really about Göbekli Tepe, and I didn't want to limit the audience. There are, for example, this ties together references that researchers from Yale University were exploring years ago, trying to understand the symbolism of Ganesha in India. My concern was, if you make the book overtly about Göbekli Tepe, you shut down any possibility that a researcher like that will want to read it unless they happen to have an interest in Göbekli Tepe.
Gotcha. That makes sense. But Göbekli Tepe is such a hot item right now. I can totally understand why they'd want to squeeze it in there.
Right. But what it did for me effectively was it closed down academic consideration of the book I'd written.
Yeah. Yeah. All right. One of the things you refer to in this book is an author named Helen Hagen and her book, The Shining Ones. Are you familiar with Christian O'Brien's book of the same name and what it says about our ancestors?
No, actually, I haven't read that, but I'll make a note to pick up a copy. I haven't read it.
Okay. All right. Well, then I can't ask you any questions.
Well,
you
can go ahead and ask me. I mean, if you explain to me what his viewpoint is, well, I can tell you.
He goes back to the oldest texts of Sumeria and translates what the Anunnaki really were, which were a civilizing group known as the Shining Ones.
Okay.
That brought agriculture and such to the hunter-gatherer tribes after the end of the last ice age.
Okay, the term Shining Ones is one that could relate to the non-material group I'm talking about.
Okay.
However, in the tradition I'm chasing, the term Anunnaki is a cosmological term. It's a term that relates to biological creation. It's not a term that really applies to a group of people.
Really?
Yes.
Can you go into that a little more?
It's in my first book called The Science of the Dogon. And the Dogon word ki refers to the concept of a nose, something shaped like a nose. And as they're talking about how biological reproduction happens, they describe essentially the processes of meiosis and mitosis. Meiosis is the process where chromosomes divide in half to create primordial cells that are going to be, you know, like a sperm or an egg cell that are going to be used to create a new egg. Mitosis is the process by which a living cell divides to reproduce. This term key refers to the chromosome, actually the genes that relate to the chromosomes as they divide, the way the Dogon use it, and the way the Dogon explain it. And so that's not to say that the term might not have another meaning also, because there's nothing in this cosmology that doesn't have meaning on multiple levels. Mm. But just as Robert Temple interpreted certain words to be about beings that I feel are cosmological, the same thing happens here, that I think the term Anunnaki is a cosmological reference that has to do with biological creation and that doesn't have to do with actual beings.
Okay, all right. Interesting. We got to take a quick break. We'll be right back with Laird Scranton.
The opinions expressed by the host and guests on Where Did the Road Go are their own and do not represent those of WVBR or its management. Join us on the web at wheredidtheroadgo.com, where you can send us questions for our live guests via email or the live chat room. You can also check out our upcoming schedule, blog, link section, book reviews, videos, and links to our Twitter, Facebook, iTunes, and much more. That's wheredidtheroadgo.com.
All right, and we're talking tonight with Laird Scranton about his latest book, China's Cosmological Prehistory, The Sophisticated Science Encoded in Civilization's Earliest Symbols. And, well, it's sort of your latest book. You have one as an e-book at the moment as well.
Well, I have a number of my books are available in print or as like Kindle-type version books, e-books. I have a follow-on to China's Cosmological Prehistory, which is called Point of Origin, which will be out in February. And then a third book that I'm referring to, working title, is The Overthrown Boat, that, if I have my way, will also be published sometime either late in 2015 or very early 2016.
Okay. All right. Now, is the follow-up to this, I thought you said it was available on Amazon, like you could get the e-book.
No, it's not. The book itself is not available, but it's listed on Amazon, and it's available for pre-order.
Gotcha. Okay. I misunderstood you earlier.
I didn't explain it properly.
Do you want to talk a little bit about the mulberry tree and how that is important to the Chinese cosmological structures?
Sure. The mulberry tree concept is referenced in Dogon cosmology, but it exists as a kind of a loose end. As you go through any one of these cultures, there are certain things that over time they've emphasized and certain things they've sort of let drop. And so anytime you research one of these cultures, you end up with a fairly substantial set of things that look like they might have been significant at one time, but we don't have enough information about to sort out what it really was. And so it sort of falls in the category of a loose end. References to the mulberry tree were that for me until I started studying China. You're probably familiar with the concept of the world tree or the tree of life.
Right.
It looks to me as if in the original tradition, there had been two trees, one that represents processes of creation in the macrocosm and the other that represents it in the microcosm. And that the world tree or the tree of life was really more given in relation to what happens in the universe as opposed to what happens at the level of matter. The mulberry tree in China includes some very interesting elements. It's defined as a tree in a lot of the same ways that the tree of life is, but there are specific aspects to the way the mulberry tree is configured that give it scientific importance. The branches of the mulberry tree and the way the berries sit on those branches end up taking the same configuration as a scientific diagram called the fundamental lemma. This is the concept of a fundamental lemma. Is it's difficult to prove, but what it refers to is that pretty much any logical theory that you're going to evolve rests on a single particular I won't say assumption, but first foundational statement. And that first foundational statement is what the concept of the fundamental lemma relates to. Now, the diagrams that scientists use to explore where that first fundamental lemma leads us to configure themselves like the branches and berries on the tree of the mulberry tree. And so trying to sort that out, mostly the evidence that I had to make that argument is based on language. I wouldn't say that it's 100% anchored, but it's so suggestive that it looks like it's probably true.
Okay. All right. And the well field system, which you've connected across Dogon, Buddhist, and Chinese systems, you want to explain that a little bit?
Sure.
And why it matters?
Okay. In China, one of the things that's emphasized in China are concepts of land management, that there's a conception of how the two earliest deities in China, in the earliest picture we have of them, one of them is holding a compass like the Masons use, and the other one is holding a square measure, also like the Masons use. The compass is used to measure out the circularity of the heavens. The square is used to measure out the squareness of the earth. And one purpose, one grand metaphor of the cosmology is to try to reconcile that the figure of the circle with the figure of the square, because that's a metaphor for reconciling processes in the universe with processes in the purview of the earth. It's as above, so below, basically. So the concept of land management is that when we talk about earth measures, the Chinese look at it in two ways. They look at it as groups of four squares, and they look at it in terms of groups of nine squares, and they conceptualize everything that way. For example, there are nine continents on the earth, and China was considered to be the central continent. This configuration plays out in the layout of the earliest Chinese civic centers, which the references are ambiguous as to whether they should be laid out according to four squares laid side to side to create a larger square of four elements, or whether the four squares should be placed corner to corner, which effectively defines nine square spaces. You can look at it either way. When you get down to agriculture, the fundamental unit of agriculture is a set of nine square plots that are configured with the central square. The central square plot represents a well that eight families who form the other eight square plots use. They share the well. Now, in China, this was considered to be a theoretical plan of land management for agriculture that some scholars feel was never actually implemented, although I found examples where in certain regions it actually was. For the Dogon, it actually was the basis for agriculture for them, and they have a very clear definition of what it's about. And so I was able to use the Dogon definitions and the Dogon words to clarify what the system meant in China.
Okay. And why as above, so below? Why is this cosmology so important to have been recorded for these people?
That gets more into the Point of Origin book, but as I was saying, that the cosmology has multiple levels to it. The concept as above, so below, at the superficial level, says that when we know the truth, we're going to discover that the processes of the universe are essentially, in some way, fundamentally the same as the processes of matter. And it's this Dogon egg of the world and Barnard's loop that the Dogon present as a way of correlating those two and demonstrating that they are fundamentally the same. But the same concept expands upward when you start talking about the formation of universes. That in the Dogen and the Buddhist and the Kabbalist conceptions of our universe, there isn't just one universe. As a matter of fact, there's a fundamental flaw that's or what's considered to be a fundamental flaw in our universe. That there's a process that happened out of sequence that caused our universe to be material as opposed to spiritual in nature. This flaw essentially is the difference between whether you have a dimension of time or you don't have a dimension of time. In the Dogen and the Buddhist conception, the non-material universe has perfect knowledge of all events, but can't act on that knowledge because they don't have time. In our universe, we have imperfect knowledge of events because we're only seeing a little short window of time at any moment.
Mm-hmm.
But we have perfect ability to act on it.
Here's a what's going to be a totally speculative question. But do you think this other universe is what people tap into when they have, for instance, altered states of consciousness on ayahuasca or DMT or something like that?
It could be. In the archaic tradition that I trace things back to, from Göbekli Tepe forward to these other traditions I study, that archaic tradition flatly states that there is communication between the non-material universe and the material one. As a matter of fact, the Dogen are very well known for creating masks, and the symbolism of the masks that they create is meant precisely to express that. It's the idea that the person behind the mask can see the people who are in front of it, but the people in front of it can't see the person behind it. And that's the fundamental relationship between these paired universes, is that the non-material side can watch what happens on the material side, but the material side can't see back. But the idea that I think it's quite possible that when someone has a shamanic experience, that what they're tapping into is something on that non-material side.
And could we also drag in things like ghosts or UFO encounters of that as well as some kind of communication from that side?
I mean, anything's possible because this is something we don't know anything about. I try in my books to talk about the things that I can anchor and to try to leave aside the things that I can't positively anchor. The way my principles for interpretation work, every interpretation has to begin with a clear statement on the part of the cultures I'm studying. That's to sort of weed out my own wishful interpretations. And then when I get to the end of the interpretation, when I'm ready to actually finally state it, I have to be able to finish a brief sentence. I have to be able to say, we know this must be true because, and finish the sentence in a way that's convincing. If I can, if I can do those two things, then the interpretation is what I call anchored. It's on a solid basis. When we come to talking about ghosts and things like that, I don't have enough knowledge about those processes to be able to say definitively that I can anchor an interpretation.
Right. Well, as I said, it was just a speculative type of a thing. Because there are so many theories of a unified paranormal theory going around that has that interdimensional counterpart to it. It seems like it might fit.
Yeah.
I mean, we don't know because there's so much we don't know about the phenomena itself.
Well, another thing that I do is, if you're familiar with the game Clue.
Uh-huh.
Okay, and Clue, every time it's a person's turn, they present a theory of who committed the murder. They say, I think it was Colonel Mustard with the candlestick in the library. And your job as a player is to look at your hand and see if you hold any card that contradicts that theory. If you hold one of those cards, it couldn't have been that particular set of circumstances, and you can disprove it. Well, anytime someone comes to me with a theory about what they think could, or a question, and says, could this be true? I look at my hand of references and I say, do I have anything here that could flatly disprove that? And if I don't, then I allow it. As far as I'm concerned, I can't say that it's not true. And that's where I stand when it comes to ghosts.
All right. Okay. do you think there's a connection between like the mandalas, the stupas, the granary and stuff, and like the later sacred geometry we find around Europe?
Yes, absolutely. I think there is. I think it all comes out of the same tradition. And the book that I've just finished writing actually makes that connection for us in certain ways to the same tradition I'm chasing.
Oh, okay. All right. One of the things a lot of people will know about ancient China is that the I Ching came out of it. And the symbols for that actually have significance to these other cultures as well, don't they?
Right, they do. All of the conception of the I Ching relates to the other cultures that I'm studying. One of the entry points to that is to understand that this tradition was not a written tradition. It was an oral tradition originally. I like to say that the language of the cosmology was originally symbolism. But in order to be able to carry it forward, it was carried forward in relation to phonetic values. And the way a word is pronounced, it became very, very important. And because a word could have multiple meanings, once you implemented written language in places like Egypt, where you have multiple glyphs that represent the same sound, you may have upward of 100 glyphs that represent the same phonetic value. These multiple meanings end up playing out like homonyms of the same word. And so pronunciation of word becomes very critical. There's an author who wrote a book called The Priests of Ancient Egypt, Sanuran, who says that in all periods of in ancient Egypt, it was understood by the priests that mere similarity of pronunciation implied a relationship between words. And that's also the way the Dogon language works. So when we're dealing with terms like Yi Jing or I Ching, the cosmology takes these phonemes and it combines them together. It sort of mixes and matches them. Each phoneme represents a concept. And if they want to create a more complicated concept, they combine phonemes to create the new concept. So I started exploring what does the phoneme Yi mean in the other cultures and what does the phoneme Jing mean. Now, Yi, in terms of the Chinese interpretation, the Dogon and the Dogon interpretation, represents the concept of change. The I Ching is called the Book of Changes, but if you were interpreting the phonemes properly, it really means the Book of Change. It's talking about a change in state of something, and the comparison is made to ice turning into water or water turning into water vapor. Hmm. In Dogon culture, that same phoneme carries that same implication, that same meaning. It's talking about a change in state of something. The phoneme G or Jing represents the concept of vibrations, but it's a complicated concept. It doesn't just mean vibration. Imagine if you're driving down the highway in a car and you have brakes that are not quite properly set. You step on the brake of the car and the car vibrates as you slow down. Well, when we're talking about the creation of matter, we have waves at the bottom. And according to the way Einstein conceives of these things, I think this was just confirmed this week, there's a difference in time frame depending on how much mass or matter an object has or how much it's accelerated. The faster your acceleration is, the slower your time frame is. That's what allows light to always be the same, bear the same speed in relationship to a person who's accelerating. And so if you follow that downward, and you get down to these waves that are essentially massless, as you reduce mass, you increase time frame. You speed things up. And so at the bottom, these waves exist in an ultra-fast time frame. And that's why the non-material side has no ability to act. It's because all events happen simultaneously at that level.
Right. And just as another piece of the paranormal puzzle, there are so many cases where UFO encounters not only mess with people's sense of time, but there are incidents like John Keel wrote about during the Mothman prophecies where these people seem to know things that were outside of, as if they were looking at it from outside of a time frame, our time frame.
Right. And I think that that's true. You get down to the level of waves or get down to the non-materialism and there's an infinitely fast time frame. That's why it appears like waves, from my perspective. If you were standing at the top of the Empire State Building watching the cars travel past, and you took photography of that, a film of that, and speeded the film up, you and as if you were increasing the time frame, the speed of the time frame, it would reach a point where the traffic looked like waves.
Huh.
I think that's what happens in our reality, is that at the bottom, things look like waves to us because of the difference in time frame. And that's also why they look random. Because right. if you have a tool that's not capable of measuring finely enough, it's as if you were trying to measure millimeters with a foot-long ruler. That you don't have the ability to measure it, and since you can't measure it, you can't predict it. If you can't predict it, it looks like it's random.
Right. Interesting.
So this concept of Jing that I was trying to get to is a complex concept of pivoting and vibrating that happen at the same moment, and it's the result of an act of perception disrupting one of these waves that exists in an infinitely fast time frame. Because it has no acceleration, and when you perceive it, Heisenberg says you have to disrupt it. The right. only thing you can do to it is accelerate it. And when you accelerate it, you slow down its time frame a little bit, and at the same time, you give it a little bit of mass. And so a simple act of perception comes along. You perceive one of these waves, and you're causing mass to exist.
And in the end, everything's sort of vibration and waves anyway. We just see it. Our brain constructs it into the reality that we see.
Right. That's right. Another example I give is, imagine that you were taking a trip across country in a car, and before you left your home, say you started out on the West Coast and you're going to travel to the East Coast, before you set out, you tuned your radio to a particular frequency for your favorite station in San Francisco. Now, as you drive across the country, there may or may not be radio stations broadcasting on that frequency as you travel across the country. And so from your perspective, if you didn't know better, as you lost one station and had not yet come into the range of the next station, you might think that radio stations were coming into and going out of existence. When in fact, all that was happening was that you were perceiving the vibration differently. You were perceiving the frequency of the transmission differently.
Interesting. One of the things you mentioned at the end of the book is you mentioned a cosmological significance to the exodus of Egypt.
Right. One of the things that happens in China that doesn't happen originally in Egypt. Okay, in Egypt and with the Dogon, what you had in the reality of those cultures was a very long period of cultural stability and the expectation of that. And so you had an esoteric tradition where the goal of the tradition was to pass information down from person to person, from generation to generation, and to hide it from outsiders. That's what the esoteric tradition was about in my view of it. But in China, where you had very little cultural stability, they couldn't count on a system of initiates to pass it down. And so, as the fail-safe, what I think they did was they took what should be secret knowledge and encoded it into little public myths that got repeated publicly by people who didn't know what they meant. And in this way, the knowledge got passed down sort of in encoded form. And so in China, all of the descriptions they have about the earliest mythical emperors of China list a series of attributes of the emperor, what he did and where he came from and what he's remembered for having accomplished and so forth. And it's given in relation to the emperor's name. If you go to the Egyptian hieroglyphic dictionary and you look up that same phonetic value as the emperor's name, you find homonyms that express all of those same attributes. So it's as if someone took a cosmological term and its multiple meanings and wrote a little myth about it, about these emperors. And from that perspective, it makes the emperor look as if they were mythical, not historical.
Right.
Now, when you go to ancient Egypt, there's a time when there's a period of upheaval, or it looks like there was, if you believe that the exodus from Egypt actually happened after a cataclysm. Suddenly, the story you have of Moses coming out of Egypt with the Israelites behaves in the same way as these stories about the Chinese emperors. It includes details that if you were to look up the phonetic values in the Egyptian hieroglyphic language, you would see that many of the attributes of the stories of what, you know, the specific details of what Moses and the Israelites did when they left Egypt play out like homonyms of these cosmological terms. And so from that perspective, it makes Moses look like he also was mythical.
Hmm.
Now, the problem with all of this is that I was made aware very early in my process, after I wrote my first book, Hidden Meanings, which got republished as The Science of the Dogon, I was made aware of the fact that many of the symbols and concepts and words that I was writing about had significance in my own life. And since that time, that trend continues, that more and more often, even into the China book and the books that follow on the China book, the things I'm writing about, if someone were to look back at my own life and compare it to the things I've written about, they would see that it looks like it's mythical, not real.
Can you give us an example?
Yes. In China, their name for the egg of the world that you correlate, you know, above and below by is Hao Hao. Well, I have a grand nephew whose middle name is Hao Ren. He's half Chinese. And his nickname is Hao Hao. So when I discovered that the Chinese term for this critical particle of matter was given in terms of the name of my great nephew, you know, it seemed odd. By the time you get to the book that I have just finished writing, it no longer plays out in terms of things that are important to my life or relate to people that I know. It plays out in terms of me. Very specific things that play out in terms of me personally.
Like?
Like my name.
How so?
I can't really explain, but the details do definitely start converging in on things that are more and more personal to me. Now, if I were studying myself 100 years from now and I saw that, my conclusion would be Laird Scranton wasn't a historical person. He was a mythical person. This can't be true.
So you think a lot of people who study, particularly the paranormal, find synchronicities to increase while they're doing this. Is this kind of what you're seeing then?
Yes. Anybody who has studied participated in this field of study and written about it, as far as I know, anyone that I've met has found synchronicities that they are hard-pressed to explain why they happen or why they're there. It just looks like they're there.
Huh.
Sometimes they're very specific and very down to earth. For example, when I was writing the first book, Hidden Meanings, I reached a point where there was a book I needed. I knew from the references that I was working with, there was a particular book I needed as the next reference. It was called Ancient Near Eastern Texts of Ancient Near Eastern Texts Relating to the Old Testament. And at the time, this was before internet searches for books, I had exhausted every possibility. It was a book that was out of print. None of the used bookstores that I had access to had it. None of the new bookstores could order it. I had tried going through Vassar College's interlibrary loan service, and they couldn't get it for me. And I finally came home to my wife, Risa, and I said, you know, it looks like I'm not going to be able to get that book. The next week, a box turns up at our back door. My wife had an aging uncle who lived in Queens, New York, who every so often would get it into his head to divest himself of a random bunch of junk. He would throw, you know, random kitchen equipment in with, you know, a pair of socks he didn't need anymore, and, you know, who knows what else. Just a bunch of random junk he didn't want anymore. He would box it up and mail it off to a relative. Well, this week, what he had boxed up and sent to me included my book, and he had no idea that I was looking for it.
Wow. That must have been mind-blowing when you opened that up.
Well, it really was, but similarly mind-blowing things continue to happen, and it reaches a point where a rational person has to accept the fact that these things are happening and not to judge them and just take them as they're given, you know?
I've always taken it as you're on the right path.
Yes. The last two books, the Point of Origin book, a year ago, a single reference fell into place for me in July of last year. And within 3 months, because of that reference falling into place, I could write an entire book.
Wow.
This year, about the same time, a single reference fell into place, and within 5 weeks, I had written a whole book.
That's fantastic.
Yeah.
Well, we're almost out of time. In the end of all this, what do you hope your work, how your work will be seen?
Well, I don't really think too much about that. I'm trying to pursue a path of research here, and I'm trying to make a set of symbols that look like a design system to me make sense. I'm a software guy. I do this. This is what my job has been with companies I write software for, is to come in from the outside and make enough sense of a system I've never seen to be able to make a critical change to it and have some hope that it's going to work. Well, I see my approach to the cosmology as being the same thing. I was able to recognize that this looked like a system to me. And I'm trying to make sense of that system. And each time a new piece of it opens up to me, I'm trying to document in a way that somebody else can follow how I understand it.
And I don't think that anybody else has come close to doing this type of work in the way that you have. So you're doing people a huge service by writing this material.
Well, thank you. I'm also doing myself a huge service, because as time goes on, these books end up becoming my own reference, because, you know, it reaches a point where, oh, now what book did I get that piece of information from? You know, somebody will ask, how do you know this is true? I can now go back to my own book and find the footnote and trace the reference.
That's awesome. All right. Well, coming up, you got the one book you've already written, which will be out in, you said, February.
Yes, we have Point of Origin that'll be out in February, which is available on Amazon right now for pre-order. And then we will have another book that I'm calling The Overthrown Boat, but we'll see what my publisher insists it be called. With Point of Origin, I made the name of the book a contingency of the submission to the publisher, and they were not real thrilled with that, but they accepted it. This time, I think there's more room for negotiation about the title, but the material in the book really is so intimately related to that term overthrown boat that that I can hardly see how the book will go forward without that title. But we'll see what happens.
And you're aiming for a release on that one when?
That's a good question. Normally, a publisher doesn't want to publish two books by the same author in less than a year.
Right.
So if we go by the publishing standard, it might be a year from February. If we go by the importance of the material to me, I'd like to see it out either the end of next year or very early in 2016.
Okay. And you're also a part of another book, correct?
Yes. There's a book that Ed Nightingale, a woodworker from Pennsylvania, has just self-published. I had self-published my first book also. This is called The Giza Template, and it'll be available at the Paradigm Symposium in next week. And I assisted with that book, and so I'm credited on it.
Okay. Was there one more thing you were involved in?
Actually, there is. There's a book out recently called, I can never remember the title. Lost Myths of the Gods? Lost Mysteries?
Lost Secrets
of the Gods, right.
Okay.
Right. I have an essay in that book, so I'm part of that book also.
Okay. All right. I have that book. I didn't realize you were in it because I haven't read the whole thing yet.
Yeah, there's a chapter there that I was asked to write at Paradigm last year, actually.
Oh, wow. Okay. All right. And Paradigm will be, it's a week from today when we're conducting this interview, which is Thursday. It'll be happening a week from when this interview airs on Saturday. It'll be almost over. But the dates for Paradigm are what, October 2nd through 5th?
Yes. I think Thursday through Sunday.
Yes, yeah. And that's in Minneapolis. And what are you going to be talking about?
I'll be talking about China's cosmological prehistory, but with the it may slop over a little bit into talking about Point of Origin, because there are a lot of people who know the book is out there and who are interested in it. It's actually selling better than some of my other titles are right now, so people know that it's there. So I've structured my presentation to be able to talk about China, but to work forward toward that next book.
Huh, okay. And it's funny if it's selling that well and it's not even going to be out till February.
Yes, that says something about the topic.
And that must make you happy, too.
Yeah, it does. I mean, I'm not in any way about the book sales. There's no way that authors like myself can hope to support themselves on book sales. So the book sales are sort of incidental to the work.
Right, right. Okay. Well, thank you so much for spending some time with us, Laird. And where can people find you online?
Okay, you can. There is a LairdScranton.com, which is not actually my site, but contact through that site gets to me. It's actually a fan site, but I'm happy with the way it presents information about me. You can find me through Facebook. Friend me on Facebook if you like. There's a publisher's page for me at Inner Traditions, and there's an author page. There's also an author page for me at Simon & Schuster.
Oh.
Who have a relationship with Inner Tradition. So they can find me any of those places.
Nice. All right. Well, we're going to take you out with some Psyche Corporation. This is Worrying World.
Come in. Come in. Do you read me? Do you understand the numbers pouring over your connection? To perfection. 5, 8, 3. Have you heard the singing soaking into our transmission? 21, 34, 55, 89. 44. Whence came this dream that haunts my mind? Behind a curtain, outside of time. Can you hear the knowledge plays, the whirring of the world? Can you hear the knowledge plays, the whirring of the world? Can you hear the of the universe. Venture cousin Tatriot, chambers number 1597, and counting, and counting. Can you hear?